Okay, and welcome to episode 25, part one of Shockwaves. I'm one of your hosts, Rob Galluzzo. Sitting with me, Mr. Elric Kane. What the hell are you drinking?
I don't know, but I'm doing dynamite. Thanks for asking, Rob.
It's Belgium.
It's Belgium beer.
Why would you need to drink all of a sudden?
I don't know. I feel so good, I don't need to drink.
I don't know, guys. Why would we drink?
We do that every week anyway, so I guess it's all right.
All I know is we are here to entertain you today.
Entertain, that is the key. That is what we are here for. Rebecca McKendry.
What's up?
Editor-in-chief, and back, our official fourth co-host. Ryan Turek.
Hello, Ringo.
I just want to say.
From now on, you'll eternally be.
You know what? Who's still around? No, I just want to say thank you for the nice, kind words on the podcast last week, and also to the listeners who were so nice. Yeah. On Twitter and social media, so thanks.
Yeah, it was a little blown out of proportion.
It was. It wasn't like
he was getting like crap.
No, I wasn't getting like Turek is a fucking asshole.
Everyone was very politely like, hey, I just feel like the dynamic slightly shifted, and it's like, there's a fourth person.
Exactly.
But I did like that everybody came to your defense and was like, lay the fuck off, Turek.
But the funny thing is, we've always had this dynamic. It was foursome is like always.
And you've also been on it before in the old show, even Killer. But the cool thing is it's a new show, and I think that, and we're gonna keep playing with it.
And I'm really happy that like it's getting split in half too. I mean, like that's the listening to the show from afar. I was like, oh yeah, this is gonna work.
And we could actually go all the way back to the origins, even before Killer POV and Bloodcast. Ryan and I were guests on a couple of Geek Nation shows together.
Oh, yeah, that's
like,
right.
Way back. Yeah, that was like long ago. Yeah.
And I mean, realistically, we totally aped the original Shockwaves. Shockwaves was a podcast on Shock T Drop in the very early days with you and Lawrence Raffel from FearNet.
Shout out to Lawrence.
So everything is connected.
It's all connected.
Yeah. Yes.
It all comes back.
But I just want to get one thing out of the way.
Okay.
I think we talked about, you know, this country has seen some some disruption this week, but you know we're not going to dwell on it. We're not going to get into it. That's not the forum. That's not what this podcast is. You know, I believe in escapism, and I believe in you know entertainment being there to kind of get you through these tough times. You know, horror has always been around for that during wars and disasters and everything. So. What we're here to do is talk about horror films, talk about fandom, talk about the things we love, keep the positivity going, and you know, give you 2 hours worth of listening that you know will hopefully turn your mind to more you know better things. So
I can't do it, man. I try. I'm breaking down. I want out.
I mean, we could go well into it, but you know.
This is therapeutic for us too.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
Not just this week in particular, but every week.
Oh, absolutely.
It's fun to get together and drink and talk.
Absolutely.
Movies.
That's why I snored my way into this podcast because I was like, Rob, gee, I need like an outlet to like talk to some.
Plus, we're like 3 feet away from your room, and you're kind of like, what are they doing in there?
What are you talking about?
Might as well just let you in.
It's Purge night. You don't sneak up on black people. My favorite quote from the new Purge.
You saw the new Purge, which we're going to get to. On top of talking about films we've seen, we're also going to tackle a topic. We're going to answer some of your questions. Like we said, splitting up the show is going to give us an opportunity to expand and do other cool things. Yeah. But before all that, quick thanks. I just wanted to thank Flood, who did an amazing write-up on Shockwaves this week. It was actually Eric Stoltz, who wrote the film Late Phases.
Yep.
Very eloquent man. It just came as a complete surprise, but a pleasant surprise, and we really appreciate that, Eric. Check out Late Phases. I think it's on Netflix Instant still, so really pleasant surprise. We really appreciate that. Also, in case you didn't realize, we do have an Instagram, a Shockwaves Instagram.
We do. Yeah,
that's snazzy.
Including that new book that Josh Forbes gave me, that slasher novel that's called Shockwaves.
Oh yeah,
I was like, where the?
Oh, that was you. I thought that was Rob.
No, he gave that to me, so I've got the copy of it. I'm super curious.
I want to read that. When you're done,
I'll pass it on.
Yeah.
The Shockwaves soundtrack is out. The book. It's all about Shockwaves.
Somebody send us Wiederhorn.
It's all happening.
He's in L.A., right?
No, he's not.
I swear, wasn't he at Horror Trivia Night one night?
No, that's Lieberman.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, Jeff Lieberman. Yeah. So. So yeah, let's jump. Well, Ryan, tell us a little bit about your journeys since you were out of town for a bit.
Yeah,
well,
you've been down in the South.
Down in New Orleans. I was away for the last week and a half prepping a film called Half to Death, which Christopher Landon's directing. And it's a fun movie. I was there for mostly prep and then the first 2 days of shooting just to make sure everything was going great. But while I was down there, I got to hang out with Kevin from Waxwork Records.
Hey,
I got to see their new digs. I was privy to some of their upcoming things and holy crap, guys. Waxwork Records is going to have a giant year in 2017. Giant. They're bringing the subscription service back, which is amazing. I was also able to find Inseminoid, the original soundtrack for Inseminoid on vinyl.
Owns Inseminoid on vinyl.
Yes. Yep. I was super stoked. I couldn't leave New Orleans without that. And
these are the people you're listening to.
Yeah. And then, and I will say too that that during my time down there, I got to meet some podcast listeners.
Oh, cool.
One of our cast crew members, Ashley Walsh.
Yeah, I know Ashley.
Yeah. So she was like, I'm kind of nerding out right now because it's Ryan. I'm talking to Ryan about horror. And
wow.
I was like, I'm kind of nerding out because I follow you on social media and love all your photos.
Yeah, Ashley works on the Scream TV show.
She does,
MTV,
yeah.
Which will be relevant for our guest next week.
Yes.
Stay tuned for that.
But super cool peeps down there. And I also got to visit. I didn't really celebrate Halloween, by the way, because I was working. And it kind of bummed me out that I was so far away from the quarter during Halloween night. But the night before, Kevin and I took a trip out to the House of Shock, mm-hmm. which is a seasonal haunt that is...
It's awesome.
It is amazing. It's part haunt and also part concert venue. Mm-hmm. So there's an outdoor stage and then there's a giant maze. And this maze rivals anything in Los Angeles.
Oh, wow.
Like the production value is beautiful. They have a giant kind of clown face building that you walk into the mouth and outside of the mouth there's a full like show going on, like a live show. So women and men were being hung up by their backs on hooks and they were swinging out over the crowd. It was amazing. But it got me in a good mood that night knowing that I was going to miss Halloween. But the maze itself takes you through multiple environments. So at first you're kind of going through a messed up carnival and then you're going through a gothic house and then you're going through kind of like you're literally going through the bowels of hell itself, which was very Fulci-esque because it was like, you know, you're literally walking through a cavern system that's in the middle of a graveyard. So you just see these bodies kind of like hanging out and coffins everywhere. But what a beautiful production. It was amazing. And everybody there was super sweet and super great. Like it was just great to see so many horror fans like in a completely different environment, you know. But if you're ever down in New Orleans, check out the House of Shock. I think they shut down for most of the year and they leave everything there. Like the buildings are all there. And the funny thing is when Kevin pulled up, this place is situated underneath an overpass. So there's just like a highway overpass and you're near some like railroad tracks. You're near like, you know, you're near the river. It's just kind of really dank and dirty and kind of
sounds like when
seedy.
You do meth.
Yeah. It's just like super sleazy. And I was like, this is a great environment. It was good. The House of Shock.
And I saw you did some Beyond tours. You took on the bridge.
I took, well, that night after House of Shock, Kevin's like, I just got to take you on the bridge. I'm like, the bridge to what? And he's like, the Beyond Bridge.
Yeah.
And
ooh.
I was like, no.
What?
It's a 29 mile bridge.
Yeah, it's epic. Yeah.
That runs off of New Orleans and bridges to the mainland. And
I can't believe they shut it down for the film because it's like such a busy.
You know what? That weighed on me heavily once I like realized because I was like, oh my God, the production.
Yeah.
Like Fulci was able to close down a section
a
of bridge.
Well,
there's no other way to go because once you're on the bridge, you can find a little like connector that gives you a chance to do a U-turn and turn you back around. But still, the Beyond, just imagine back in like 79, 80, the Beyond disrupted some traffic in New Orleans. I wanted to go to the house.
Is it still standing?
The house is still standing. Ooh. It's like a museum or something like that now. But I would have had to take the bridge over there, which was about a 30-minute drive, and then a little bit deeper into the woods. But I didn't have an opportunity to. But I saw it. So next time I will.
Yeah, I would go for that.
Wow.
That's cool.
Yeah, very cool. What did you guys see?
Well, I saw Who Purge Election.
Oh, Tucker.
Yeah, let's
You know
start
what's
with
ironic
that.
Is I think a lot of our choices are actually going to be relevant.
Yeah. See,
but go ahead. Start with
well,
the
I mean, that was I said I wanted to watch it the day before. I wanted to watch it a while ago. But, you know, I actually thought it was quite a fun movie. I didn't like it quite as much as 2, but 2 is like kind of a real high point, I think, in that series so far in terms of an action film. But there was a lot of stuff I like. The only I still have the only criticism I ever have about the Purge films. It's always the same thing. It's like the kind of general characters. They're all like types. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
And so, which also I get why, because it's big movies. And they're more like action films than horror films, and that plays better. But in terms of actual visual horror, this film is actually quite fun at the little cutaways of just total macabre fucking dark shit happening to people.
It's a little bit more grisly than the
predecessors. It's definitely more like a horror film than an action than the last one. Yeah. That last one just balls out action to me. Yeah, I had a lot of fun watching it. I'm glad the carnage, when I say general, remember The Following, the show? When you had characters in death, The Following always had the thing where it's like, you know, perfectly watchable, but you never gave a shit when people died.
Because everybody died.
Yeah,
constantly.
And by the end of this, I mean, there's a couple characters, obviously, you don't want to die, but if, other than that, you're like, it's all up for grabs.
I did really love the idea of the death tourism.
Oh, yeah, I mean, yeah.
I thought that was such a smart inclusion.
The foreign,
foreigners coming to America.
Like, you just come to America to kill somebody. It was very hostile-like, but,
I definitely thought of Eli Roth in that moment. It definitely also made me think, it would be a really fun series to see, like, other people get to do spin-offs of other directors, their spin on this a great idea. It's a great concept that's out there now. We understand The Purge, and then like seeing other people run with it.
Yeah.
I kept going, man, you know what? I'd really like to have seen a Ruggero Deodato 70s version of this that with David Hasselhoff. Just ugly.
So many intestines.
I will say that, you know, we're particularly proud of the fact that DeMonico has been on this franchise from the get-go. It's a creator
it's his vision.
Like, it's a creator vision, you know?
Yeah, I see that.
And so we're especially proud of the fact that he did, you know, 1, not knowing how it would take off, and then coming back for 2 and coming back for 3, and like having that fully, you know, that full idea of where he wanted to go with it, you know.
There's closure to the 3 films. So for those who haven't seen it yet, I won't ruin it, but those 3 could just be its own series, and you can now go anywhere if you wanted. I feel like that story is now done.
Yeah,
to me.
I like that about it.
And I think that's a nice closure. And it was, to be perfectly honest, much more optimistic than what happened last night. I felt a lot worse last night than I did after the end of the
I will say that The Purge is a highly pitchable kind of concept. We hear it a lot. We see it on social media a lot. I think during election night, we were getting like bombarded with ideas, but it's like in DeMonico, we trust. And he always finds a way to kind of the ideas that you're talking about or the ideas that you want, like the things you want to see the series delve into, he'll get there. It just takes a little, you know, you don't want to cram it all into one movie.
Right. So he's the one I have to pitch
Predator
to.
Yeah.
He's the guy. If I get it in his ear, suddenly you'll listen.
Purgator.
I think John Holland did an image
I didn't see it.
Yeah, it's on our Facebook.
No, he didn't. Did he really?
It's amazing. Put the Predator in the middle of the Purge Zone, and it actually looks kind of awesome.
You know, like crush a skull.
I'd see that movie.
I have to look
There's actually a similar concept. There's an episode of Rick and Morty where they visit a planet right as that planet is having their yearly purge, so it's like the aliens entering the purge. It's amusing.
Yeah. It's great high concept stuff.
That's cool. What else did you see?
I saw a really good double feature. I borrowed the Rabid Blu-ray from Becca, the new release, and I doubled it with Slugs. And this was a
I watched Slugs too. You watched the Arrow Blu-ray. I watched Slugs as well. That's on my list.
You want an entertaining evening? Watch these two sleazy ass films. Rabid's a lot sleazier than I remembered. It's also a lot goofier. Compared to other Cronenberg, there is goofy cameos and weird side characters.
It doesn't hold up as well as a lot. Like I watch Shivers now, and I'm still like, damn, this is a tight little film.
Yeah, those
same
are good.
With The Brood. I watch Rabid, and I'm like, it's got a little side.
Well, what it's
stuff.
Got? What's interesting? Because I actually totally agree with you. Because Rabid's the one I've been waiting to rewatch the most of any Blu-ray, really. Mm-hmm. Like, been just holding out for it to come on Blu-ray. And rewatching, I'm like, no, the idea is still fucking amazing.
Yeah.
The effect, the payoff shots are great. But there's a lot of fat to that movie.
Yeah.
And he becomes such a better director as he goes at tightening. Like, by the time you get The Fly, there's not a wasted moment in his movie.
How early is that? Is that his first?
It's his second.
Film. Shivers was first.
That, and then
I gotcha.
Brood.
But Shivers feels really tight. And maybe that's just because it is such a confined film anyway. So when it does get meandering, you feel like it's necessary.
And that one has multiple characters in a way that makes sense because it's spreading. This one has the boyfriend character is a terrible actor.
Yeah.
That's a terrible performance. You've got a porn star in the lead, and her performance is fun because it suits the sexual story.
It has its moments.
But I still love Rabbit. It's still a cool movie, but I agree with you completely, actually. But Slugs
is amazing.
It was so much fucking fun.
Oh my God.
Speaking of Cerebral, let's just turn to Slugs.
No, it's surprisingly.
Who directed it? Same director as Pieces, baby.
Yeah.
Yes.
Juan Picard,
no
Simon.
Way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. that.
And Slugs, it's a well put together film. As I was watching it, it follows the same kind of Purge concept where it follows a couple of different characters on their story as slugs erupt on the town. So, like, you're seeing all these different characters throughout the whole thing, and then they never really intersect, but you're getting, like, seven different stories of what's going
on.
Yeah,
it's like a nothing movie that happens to have, like, just great payoff shots.
Yeah.
You know, like, the moments
but
where
it,
people
it can't
like,
be as fun as Pieces.
It's not as good as Pieces.
It's not as good.
It's got some payoff moments that are in that ballpark.
Amazing.
Like, that are just absurd. But yeah. The funniest thing about it is these scenes where they'll just get in a car and just drive, and you're just watching a car drive, and the music will be played at, like, full tilt orchestral score, and you're going, but nothing's happening, and it's one of the worst like worst juxtapositions I think I've ever seen.
It's when I learned that slugs permanently have parasites that live in their guts. And they grow to immense proportions.
But I have not watched the extras. I hear the extras are quite good.
I haven't watched the extras yet. I remembered Slugs from my childhood because we had it on VHS. My parents had a copy of Slugs that we owned as a family. Yeah. And so I had seen it a ton before. So there were certain scenes that I remembered, like the scene where the slugs actually pull the guy away.
The effects are actually good.
You
see a slug budget
with teeth that actually looks really legit. Like the slug with teeth that bites her finger. It looks
good. It's actually really good.
The scene where the guy like hacksaws off his own hand, it looks good. So yeah,
I the Arrow films elevates these things.
That was an Arrow. It was funny because I like when those things get announced, I immediately pre-order them on Amazon, and then I have to kind of go back and go, maybe I don't need slugs this month. I should eat some food.
I don't know if that's one you need to own.
I
feel like you could borrow that.
I bought it. You can borrow mine, but I need that one back because that's one that I pre-ordered slugs just because my parents had it. And I was like, it's like a childhood memory for me.
Had you guys seen He Knows You're Alone before?
Yeah.
No, I have not.
See, I'd never seen it. It's Tom Hanks. A whole bunch of people are in it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So TCM, this is just kind of controversial because it was the day Daylight Savings happened. And I tweeted, hey, Alone in the Dark by Jack Shoulder. And then He Knows You're Alone back to back, fucking A. And so a lot of people actually recorded them, and every single one of us next day go, and He Knows You're Alone, you only get the first hour of it, and that cuts out because the time zone difference
happened,
and they fucked it all up. So everyone's writing TCM going, what's the second half? I only saw the first half, so I'm not even gonna I'm not gonna sit here and talk, but the opening scene was fucking rad.
It's on either Shudder or Hulu Amazon.
I'll get
out
the
there.
Second half. It's really fun. It opens with a great movie theater death, and I'm thinking of actually writing a movie theater death scene and horror film list for you guys, because it really was a fun, big movie. It was actually, you can tell Scream 2 probably directly took that scene from the opening scene. And then just real quickly, I've been continuing this film noir horror that I wanted to go on. So I had a sickie the other day where I got to watch the Criterion release of Cat People, which is gorgeous, sexual, just a Jacques Tenier, one of the best.
We have a good article that went up on the site today about Cat People.
Earlier this week.
Earlier this week.
And then I recorded on TCM Curse of the Cat People, which is directed by Robert Wise, who did The Haunting, and it couldn't be more. It has some of the same actors. Cat People aren't in it at all. It's a children fantasy film, basically. There's no horror, even though it's called Curse Cat, and it was sold as a horror film.
Was Val Lewton still involved in that
one? Yeah, this is still Val Lewton produced. It's like he slipped in this amazing fairy tale kids film, and it's beautiful. It's like a perfect little movie, but it has nothing to do, I mean, except for it's the kid of the guy from the first one. And but what's cool about it is it takes place in Terrytown, and so they keep talking about the legend of Sleepy Hollow throughout the film. So it's like, oh, we are in Sleepy Hollow, and they tell the story of the Headless Horseman. But so it's just a beautiful little movie. And my favorite of the ones I've seen so far to end on is the one you were talking about last week, which I realized I hadn't seen, which is The Seventh Victim.
I'm so glad you watched that.
Because I thought I kept mixing it up with Curse of the Demon, because Curse of the Demon, which I know well, is
it's great.
Similar kind of.
It's Jacques Tourneur.
Yeah, that Tourneur, and then it's Tourneur, a Satanist. But this one, this will probably be my pick so far. I mean, I'm going to be watching I Walk with a Zombie again, which I haven't seen in years,
which is
and I
surprisingly
love it.
Racist. I rewatched it a couple of weeks
ago.
Well,
not surprisingly, because of the time
period. No, it's very racist. No, I rewatched it a couple weeks ago when I was doing my top scary films from the 40s list, and I was like, oh my God, I completely forgot how racist this movie is.
But Becca, nothing's racist anymore.
Nothing. Okay. Sorry. Sorry.
It's a new world.
I forgot.
New world order.
I'm a woman.
Racist.
I'll go sit in the corner.
There is no racist. But Seventh Victim, if you haven't seen it, that would be the one I would pick out right now, because it's very strange in its tone. It's about a cult of Satanists. It is just like the use of lighting and expressionism to drive a whole movie. Psycho has a total reference of the shower curtain scene, and it's awesome. That scene where somebody's like menacing you behind a shower curtain, just talking as a shadow.
I love The Seventh Victim because it was a horror film set in New York City in the 1940s, which is just an amazing landscape to begin with. But you just kind of, you don't see a lot of filmmaking in New York City that really kind of embraces the city until it gets gross in the 80s. Like you see it in the 70s and 80s, but it was amazing. It takes place mostly in Greenwich Village.
And it's just, it's Greenwich Village. It's super shocking ending. It's one of those things that you reevaluate how you watch the movie. Directed by Mark Robson, who was one of Orson Welles. He might have been the editor on Citizen Kane. All these guys seems to have, because they're RKO, so they've all worked with Welles and then Val Lewton. So anyway, I'm really enjoying this series.
The main woman in that, I always called her the original goth girl.
Yeah, she's
totally incredible. Goth. She's totally goth.
But yeah, so that's why I'm going to keep doing these for the next, until I get through all the Lewtons.
Wow. Dementia.
Yeah. Having fun. Yeah, I'll get to that next.
Okay.
What about you, Becca?
Well, I watched Slugs, which was definitely the highlight of my week. I watched the fancy...
Highlight of the week?
Yeah, really. Compared to these other ones. I watched the Fancy Pants Blue Underground release of Manhattan Baby from Fulci.
Oh, I want to borrow that.
That was a tough one. It's a slog.
Really?
Oh, my God.
I remember it being a rough film.
It's Fulci, but like Fulci slow. Yeah. And Fulci slow to begin with, but it's Fulci slow.
Well, this October I was so optimistic because I've always liked Fulci movies. I used to confuse a lot of them, but... But for some reason, I saw The Beyond at Beyond Fest, and then I immediately watched City of the Living Dead. And I've always liked those movies, but for some reason now, something clicked in me where like they were perfect. Like I every aspect of it, I followed the story perfectly this time, whereas most of the time they're kind of confusing. So I'm like, oh, man, I get Fulci now. I'm at the ripe age to understand.
You're at the Fulci peak.
Thought you got Fulci.
I finally got him. And then I threw on Manhattan Baby, and I was like, nah.
Nope.
Not so much.
It's a little rough. No, and it was definitely one of these movies where I'm like, I'm watching it, and then I'm like, I should go change over the laundry because nothing's fucking happening.
Yeah.
But the soundtrack is awesome. So I put the soundtrack in my car and I've been listening to it. Cool. And it really like it makes my drive on the 101 like sound epic.
I'll borrow it before I buy it.
Yeah, and that said, Blue Underground did do, as always, they did a great job.
It looks gorgeous.
Looks amazing. If I'm not mistaken, that's the one. There's actually, I believe there's a little like in the studio featurette of... Fabio Frizzi and his live band playing Manhattan Baby music.
The soundtrack
like,
is beautiful.
It's almost like a live music video of them doing the music, which is awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome little
I think I used
feature.
To get that mixed up with the Babo and Kill Baby Kill, which is a great movie.
Kill Baby Kill is awesome.
I remember watching Manhattan, oh, is this that great movie? And then go, oh.
No,
it's not the great movie.
No. This is Little Girl Goes With Her Family to Egypt and Gets Possessed.
That's it, yeah.
Okay.
It's a slog.
And then comes back to New York?
Comes back to New York.
Okay.
So it's a full to New York film, so that's kind of cool.
Manhattan.
Exactly.
So then after that, well, I did. This is not horror, so I'll touch on it briefly, but I've been working my way through Twilight Time's new releases. So I watched Murphy's Law, which does not hold up as well as I remember it from when I was a kid. And then I watched Rollerball, which still totally kicks ass.
Oh, Rollerball kicks ass.
That was great.
So yeah, fun stuff from Twilight Time. I decided to go back. I've been doing a lot of band titles on the website lately, kind of going through things that were banned years ago, like decades ago.
I thought you were talking about
like
big bands.
Not like bands or Charlie Band. Like banned films from years past, going back, watching them again, and then seeing, you know, why they might have been banned and kind of evaluating. So I went back and watched Masters of Horror's Imprint episode from 2006 to see why it was banned, does it still hold up, and all that stuff. It's still pretty fucking hardcore. The rubber fetus budget on that one must have been pretty damn high.
Rubber fetus river?
Rubber fetus river. Oh my God.
Taking a tour.
I think it was on Icons of Friday to interview with Mick Garris, and we started talking about that, and I was like, you know, when Billy Drago is the least weird thing of your short, you made something fucked up.
He was still pretty weird, though. Like I wrote,
but compared to the rest of the stuff in that
No. I wrote in the article that like his acting ranged between like down-gazed mumbling and like chewing the scenery in like wailing and like it was just bizarre acting. But yeah, when you're in there with everything else that's going on, it was kind of like, oh well, Billy's doing his thing. But oh my God, everything else. Yeah, and it's really hyper stylized, and I still really feel like Mike was trying to make some type of statement in it, but I have no idea what it was, and I don't know if it was just lost on Western audiences. But it really feels like Audition obviously has a bigger social statement. Visitor Q has a bigger social statement. E.G. the Killer. But this one,
I just think that guy's making making 100 movies a year. He doesn't care. He's just like, I'm just rolling.
The output to quality ratio is, I mean, like, I there was a point where I was like, oh, okay, you're just going to keep cranking them out.
Yeah.
And occasionally one will surprise us.
One will surprise us.
One will raise to the
Usually I rely on Fantasia and Mitch Davis and the programmers there, because if they have him there and they have a film there, then I'm like, okay, and you guys I trust, I'll go check it out.
I don't know. I wasn't into his film this year. I can't remember. What was the name of it?
It was like
the one last year was like Over Your Dead Body. I think Scream Factory put it out.
Yeah. I can't remember the name this year, but it was about the school.
Right.
And it was not my fave film there.
You know what? My memory of Imprint, because I haven't seen it in years, but I really liked it. But my memory of it was, I wish it was in Japanese, because another part of that Mick Garris interview is that everyone spoke English in it, but all the Japanese actors didn't speak English. So they're actually just saying their lines phonetically. So they didn't even know what they were saying.
That makes so much sense
now. I was kind of like, I don't know if it was a Showtime mandate or what.
Probably.
But it's like, just make it Japanese with subtitles.
I don't remember Dreamboat, because they did the Dreamboat episode.
That was
in season two. Yeah.
And I think maybe they learned from that for season two.
I don't remember that one being in English.
But also, that's what makes it weird, is the delivery of all the Japanese actors, because they have no idea what they're saying, because they're just speaking phonetically from what they assume the words are supposed to sound like.
Right. Wow. Okay, that makes more sense now.
Yeah.
Let's see. As much as I was making fun of Ryan for buying Inseminoid on vinyl, I was at a thrift store in North Hollywood and picked up Vanishing Point, Nightmare on Elm Street, and Suspiria on Laserdisc.
Ooh.
Not that I even own a Laserdisc player anymore, but I was just like, these are kind of badass. So that's just a note. The last thing I'll mention.
Thanks for that. I hope we need a spinoff podcast of just your like
cool
thrift store.
Becca's tangential.
Oh, no.
Becca's
what
thrift
I found
store.
This week.
Cool. What?
My husband got a shirt.
Not Inseminoid on vinyl, assholes.
How much did that cost again?
Oh, my God.
For your girlfriend listening?
Forget it. The last thing I was going to – well, I will say Exorcist. I am still totally into.
Oh, yeah, TV-wise.
Haven't seen it yet.
Really, really good
stuff. Oh, I wanted to ask if we're all on board or not.
I'm still on board.
Yeah,
I actually like
it's awesome.
I like the direction they're now taking it now that we know what we know.
Now
I can honestly say
it.
There's about 2 minutes where I wasn't sure, though. There's about 2 minutes in the new one, like right at the start, where I'm like, is the tone going to change here? I was like, uh-oh.
Yeah.
And then it totally came back.
Huh. Yeah, and that's because I think I never thought of that angle. You'll understand what I mean. In the opening, they kind of present something from the original movie.
Sure.
And then it closes on a way where you're like, oh,
yeah.
I never thought about that. So I thought that was a good end.
But it's still good.
For the rest of the show.
Yeah.
And also, I have to say, Ash vs. Evil Dead continues to be awesome.
Behind again.
But even better, and you know, they brought Cheryl back this week, which is great.
Right.
Tie in Evil Dead. And man, I don't know what her secret is, but Ellen Sanweis has not aged in 35 years. She looks like exactly the same as she did in the original Evil
She's
Dead.
Dead-eye.
But you will enjoy, if you haven't seen it yet, you will enjoy the jokes made at the expense of what happened to her.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Oh, okay.
There are some new phrases I never would have thought of until
nice.
Ash
nice.
Spit them out.
That's
so
nice.
Now, are you guys caught up on Candle Cove as well?
No.
Not last night.
Way behind on
but
it.
I'm
yeah, I didn't do last night's. But the week before, and this is weird, I actually had like a mini nightmare about it. It was bizarre. Like I watched it right before I went to
it
bed.
It definitely has that quality. Unlike most shows. Most shows are like so narratively focused. This one definitely is pretty dreamy.
Yeah.
Like the imagery doesn't tell you what they are.
You're
just lingering in your mind.
Yeah, it was. And this has been in all of the episodes so far, so I'm not revealing anything, but they always show the tooth guy sucking on the guy's hand while he sleeps. And I literally, I had a nightmare where like that thing was in the room going after my hand. And
it's
then
like
I woke up
baby.
And I was like, this is just dumb. The dog's like got my hand in his mouth.
That's good stuff.
So but I am loving
it
so
great.
Far.
And there's only a couple left, and then we'll wait for
I think it's six total, right?
Yeah.
Because I watched the first one and I liked it, but I was like, you know what? I need to rewatch that because, again, it seemed like very dense storytelling.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
But now that they're almost done with it, I think I want to carve a weekend out to just watch all
it. It feels like a movie.
And
I think
it feels
works,
very
yeah.
cinematic.
I feel like
yeah.
they would do well binge watch. And don't lose it on the third one was kind of the biggest, the driest for me, but it was really plot heavy.
They bring it back.
Yeah.
It's good stuff.
Yeah, it's fine. I'm looking forward to
catch up on all of it this week.
Excellent. I'm not impressed, though, with where American Horror Story is going. You guys got on that?
It's like the same story every year with you guys.
Becca's usually a defender.
I'm into it. I'm usually into it.
No,
oh, I don't know about
now. I'm usually way into it.
The Walking Dead effect. You know?
Yeah. This last episode, they totally went torture porn. And then I was kind of like, I'm bored. And then they brought it back a little bit at the end. But I'm usually like the biggest defender of that show. But this last episode, I was like,
How many more are there? Are they all like on the second half at this point?
No,
they're on the second half. And they've got like a couple just... Three episodes.
And I remember number 10 changes again, so you're not up to that yet. So once
one more time?
Yeah, a big, like.
That's what they say.
Somebody said to me, huge changes.
Yeah. Okay, so, I'm caught up to last week.
I don't even know who tells us these things.
Yeah, who's your
insider.
I heard about this.
I hear about this.
Elric's got a bird that shows up every morning and
whispers
about it. Here's the scoop on American Horror Story.
And what about, are you still keeping up on
He sounds like he's from New York.
Walking Dead?
Yeah. Are you?
Yeah.
I really, really like the last one because of the. It took a character who's a nothing character in the series, like a side character, and gave him an entire episode. And I really liked learning about that side of things and getting their motivation. I thought that was a really interesting episode.
Sure,
but I do want to see the characters who are meant to be suffering.
Oh yeah,
so I haven't seen them for two episodes now.
That's the thing. It's like that. I don't know how that show does it, but it skates the fine line about like. We're going to fuck with you so hard,
and
you're not going to see those people for five episodes.
Yeah, for 4 weeks.
We're going to go, and Joe Blow here is going to get his own episode.
But I got to bet, I've never been a big Daryl guy. Like, I see why he's popular. But there's something he does at the end of the episode where I literally went, fuck yeah, Daryl.
Yeah.
Like, you're a fucking beast. And so that was cool.
It was good to give him
He still gets my vote. He's still cool. So.
All right. Well, I dig it. All right, so for me, this is really quick. I just wanted to mention... Scream Factory's release of Carrie came out on Blu-ray. Absolutely fantastic. You know, I haven't seen it in a couple of years. I revisit it every once in a while. And in particular, I didn't revisit it because I wanted to see the other ones fresh. Like, they had put out The Rage Carrie 2, which I like a lot. And I wanted to give the Fuller one another chance, the one with Angela Bettis. And to me, the new thing is I'd rather, if I'm going to watch a sequel or a remake or whatever it is, I choose not to marathon them anymore. I just want to see that movie on its own without the other one fresh in my head. But, I mean, Carrie is like kind of perfect.
Yeah. I watch it every year.
The pacing of it, the timing of it, the new scan is fantastic. It looks great because the previous Blu-ray that MGM put out was very, very grainy. And there was like a lot of pixelation and noise in it. But as always, Scream Factory did a fantastic job. So it's a classic. You should own it anyway.
I think it's his best performance. Like, I like a lot of De Palma, but sometimes I feel like because he's so involved in his camera movements, he forgets about the performance. The performances in there are so good.
Terrific.
Grounded. Yeah. You're in the opening scene. You're with her. You feel for her. Piper Laurie's fucking amazing.
Yeah, they're both amazing. I really love the coach. The coach is my favorite character because she yells at the girls and slaps Nancy Allen in one scene. One scene's great, you know? So,
and all the young people have never looked, but they're at their peak.
Oh, yeah,
all these
absolutely.
Young people like Travolta.
Absolutely. And quite frankly, I was thinking about, they showed it here in celebration of this release at the Ace Theater in Los Angeles. And the one gimmick they did is at the end, when Carrie kind of takes control of the room and hits the red lights, the red lights came on in the entire theater at the same time. There's a little video of it on the Scream Factory page. And it's like, it gave me chills watching it because it's super cool the way they synchronized it. And yeah, to this day, I think that end sequence, much like the shower scene in Psycho, it's like, I don't know if you could ever top, a split screen prom massacre the way that De Palma did in that movie. So highly recommend it if you don't have that release yet or if you're thinking about getting the Blu-ray, the new Scream is the one to get. So that's that. I got a lot of love for Severin this week. Two titles. The second one will lead us into our first topic. The first I'm holding here, which is kind of you saw The Purge. Yeah. I saw The Killing of America.
Which we talked about that a long time ago, right?
Yeah. We talked about this.
I had seen it on
Here's the deal.
A kid.
We talked about this a lot on Killer POV.
Yeah.
And in fact, after we talked about it, because this has been banned here in the U.S.
Yeah, it was never available here.
It came out in 1981. It's directed by Sheldon Rennan, but the producers behind it, one of them is Leonard Schrader, who is Paul Schrader's brother. And this is – yeah, and we talked about this on Killer POV, and when you – it's a kind of documentary and history on real life violence around the country from what I understood when you were explaining it to me.
How would you ban that if it's all documental?
Presented, well, at least I always thought it was presented in a Faces of Death
that's
style.
That's what I thought too.
Where it's more like a Mondo film.
And in fact, I bought, when you talked about it on Killer POV, I bought the import DVD of it and I just never had the courage to watch it.
It sounds intense.
Because you think, because I was expecting a Faces of Death style thing. And now Severin have done this new restoration on Blu-ray. There's two versions of it. There's the English language one, and apparently this was huge in Japan, so they made a much longer Japanese version. I haven't watched
I'm really
that
intrigued
yet.
Why that was huge in Japan.
You know what?
They're sick fucks. That's your shit.
They released it there as Violence USA.
There you go.
Yeah, so it was like an exploitation thing.
Yeah, I guess so. But anyway, this is not what you think at all. It wasn't a Faces of Death thing. There is real graphic violence in it, but it's actually a really interesting and compelling documentary that goes way back to like the early 60s or so and on, and kind of, you know, there's a narrator, there's score and music, and it kind of just shows the increasing the escalation of violence throughout the country, starting with, you know, like the assassination of JFK. They cover that a bit, and then his brother Robert, and then, you know, Martin Luther King, John Lennon. You kind of got to see how that
becomes
affected.
Almost regular.
It became accepted and how people reacted to it, and et cetera. And then it's weird. It kind of morphs halfway through into like serial killer stuff.
More sensational
stuff.
Because
then they touched on Ted Bundy, and you see footage of him in court, which you know, we kind of laughed at because, I mean, he's terrifying to me. Like, he's my scariest.
Yeah, because he defended himself.
But like the level of defiance he shows the judge in court, like he's trying to walk out one point and they're like, sit down. And he's like,
he tries to walk out of court?
Yeah, he's like,
he escaped one time from prison by in the prison library because he was defending himself.
That's
jumped out the window.
To me. Uh-huh. He like opened the window, jumped out, and then went and killed a bunch of girls
for another couple months he was out.
Like, it's unbelievable.
He's an amazing figure.
They touch upon that. There's another killer. I think it's Ed Kemper?
Or Gacy?
Ed Kemper.
Now, there is some really, I mean, they interviewed him. So there's a long interview with him in the doc that's just exclusive to this, and it is pretty damn chilling.
Yeah.
But I found it fascinating, and more than anything, you know, this came out literally on Election Day, which I'm sure Severin was banking on that.
Good timing.
It is.
I think they tipped the election with this release.
It is so relevant, but more than anything, and I was telling Ryan this off camera. It is totally like almost nothing has changed.
Yeah.
I know that's the saddest thing to say, and the reason being is because at one point they do the. They talk about the
Charles Whitman,
the shooting in Texas, which was 1966. Guy who randomly went up on a rooftop and started shooting people for no reason. He just lost it.
Clock Tower.
Killed,
right?
Clock Tower. Killed his wife and mother before he did it. And he got gunned down. And there's footage in here of a politician, 1966, after this massacre, who is saying, we have to regulate gun control.
Yeah.
We have to do it. Right. This is too much. We have to do something about it. And I'm like watching this footage thinking, holy shit, this is 66.
Yep.
40 years.
And the documentary was made in
81. It came out in 81. And it's like nothing has changed. So that's the kind of sad, shocking reality.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think the only difference is it's spread through social media now.
Yeah,
and
well, that's the thing. What that is a realization of, I mean, what we've always known is like this stuff has been prevalent for decades.
Yeah.
Like this is, it's nothing's changed.
Well, in America, what's forged and bloodshed,
right? Totally. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Conflict, and what's happening is that, you know, social media is bringing us closer together. Information is bringing us closer together. So, you know, it's just like that's what you watched last night is like just a reminder. Hey, by the way, everything's been awful.
It's always 60s. Sucked, guys.
It's a reverse of the Lego song. Everything is awesome. It's like, no. Everything is awful.
Everything's always sucked.
It actually made me, even last night, reminded me of Mark Duplass was on that B thing. And the one thing he said about filmmakers, he said, advice to up-and-coming filmmakers, guys, I only have one piece of advice. There's no cavalry coming. If you want to get this done, you have to do it yourself. No one is coming to save you. And I felt the same way about the election afterwards. I was like, oh, we can't just wait around assuming things are going to work out for us now. It's like it's up to every person to make the future they want to make.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I feel this. I feel like documentaries like that really bring that home. You're like, oh, there's a lot of bleak shit in the world. Sure there is. But, you know, do you have to accept that? Fuck no. You know, today I'll be a lot more optimistic, obviously. But in general, I really do feel like, you know, hey, there's no cavalry. It's kind of freeing to know that. And you can only become an adult to know that, because as a kid, there is a cavalry, your parents or whatever.
Yeah, of course.
So,
yeah.
So it does a change, you know.
Yeah, well, I think they did an excellent job with this release, and I actually strongly recommend it. Again, I was kind of scared to watch it, but I thought it was excellent. Really great. And there's some cool new special features. They talked to the director. They touch on some of the Manson stuff as well. But then the other Severin thing I brought with me, and I think Becca has it too.
The Dracula.
It's a new documentary called The Trail of Dracula. It's a little over an hour long. Initially, I thought it was supposed to be a special feature on the Jesse Franco Count Dracula release. Mm-hmm. And instead, they opted to just make it its own separate thing. Who did this? It's written and directed by David Mitcher. The reason I wanted to talk about Dracula was because, you know, we had an article on the website about, is Dracula still scary? And the other thing is, I've said plenty on the show that I've not really gotten heavily into the Hammer period. I'm slowly now starting to watch a lot of those films. So of the movie monsters, I always love the Wolfman. I always love the creature. Dracula's kind of very low on my totem pole in terms of movie monsters that I love, and it's not that I don't love the character or the films I've seen. It's just that the films I tend to see tend to be the exact same retelling of the Dracula legend. You know, it's the same thing. It's, you know, Renfield and Van Helsing, and, you know, they
love,
move into
long lost love.
That's why Dracula
2000 is so good, because it takes the model and breaks it and makes
he's in a band.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the things that I really enjoyed this documentary, and there's tons of cool stuff on the DVD to make it like worthwhile. Like there's a 95 minute trailer reel of all Dracula movies. So if you just want to throw that on in the background, that's kind of neat. But I liked going through the history and hearing about the original novel, at what point the romanticism of it, because, you know, it was a play for a while. They talk about Nosferatu, that version of it, which to me is the most terrifying version of Dracula.
And Vampyr, the drier. Just after that. Yeah.
Yeah. And, one thing I didn't know was, like, because Bela Lugosi is obviously most well known for Dracula, and yet he only played it on screen twice, in the original and in Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. Yep. I had no idea that they just never asked him again. He did it. There might have been some sort of disagreement with his representation in terms of what was the second one?
Dracula's daughter. Yeah.
Yeah, because he's in the very beginning. It's a lookalike, but it's not Bela Lugosi.
Right.
And apparently, you know, they get to the point where they talk about Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, and it's like Bela apparently and his representation begged to let him play that role. Huh. And I think, you know, now in retrospect, you're like, of course you got to get Bela. He's Dracula. Yeah. But the fact that they made all these movies without him and
that
didn't even
ask him. That fact, because I don't know that either, but I might be touched on in Ed Wood. I have a feeling it is, because that desperation of his character
comes
through.
Yeah. Or it's personal. Yeah. I mean, usually it's through, you know, if you're not being asked back, it's because, personal stuff.
Yeah. So I found that aspect interesting. And even all the, they delve into Christopher Lee stuff. And here's what I love about that guy. Not only was he a great Dracula, but he reprised it, I think, more than any other person. He played it like 13 times.
And for different
times.
People, too. I mean, he did the Spanish.
Oh, yeah, he did the Spanish. Yeah. He did all these different versions of Dracula. And he's very – I guess it's from a panel somewhere, the footage of him talking about it. And I've actually read this before. He really didn't want to keep coming back. But bless him, every time he said yes, he said he did it for the crew. Because the same crew worked on all the movies, and he'd always get a phone call. He's like, I'm not going to do another Dracula. And they'd call him. He's like, look, it will happen if your name is on it. Like, we will get the money. If you don't do it, all these people worked on the last movie will be out of work.
Right.
Oh, wow.
So he literally was like, I just can't let my friends
and
not
And he's
work.
Like, I'll do it but with a handlebar. I'm keeping the handlebar for Dracula.
Only if it's in the 70s.
So I thought that was really sweet and interesting that he kept doing it primarily so people could keep working. Because the movie would get made if he was in it.
Well, the first one he's in, and the first time you've seen it, he is one of the best Draculas for that. Those moments where he turns with the blood. He really looks like what the character is in your brain.
Right.
You know, as it goes on, it becomes a trope, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the reason I wanted to bring it up is not only did I think the documentary was excellent, and I just love docs of this sort that kind of give you the history of a certain type of horror trope, but I want to know what your favorite, like, Dracula-style movies are, because in the last couple of years, the ones that really excite me are, believe it or not, Blackula. I'd never seen Blackula until the Blu-ray came out. I'm like, this is like a really good reinterpretation. it had like scary like Salem's Lot style vampires in it. I'm like, this is really good.
I think it actually gets disregarded a lot because people, I mean, it is part of blaxploitation, but people just assume that because it is an exploitation movie that it's crap. And it's actually a good movie.
I think
movie.
It's the title.
The guy's a great actor.
Well, yeah. The title's a joke.
But the irony is, it is exploitation, but it's actually a really good Dracula movie. Yeah. And even the sequel's not bad. The sequel has Pam Grier in it. Mm-hmm. I always like how they figure out how to continue these movies. Or I was like, well, we totally killed them last time.
Right.
But here's what we do. And another one I really liked was The Return of Count Yorg. I'd never seen.
I haven't seen that one.
And I thought that was really excellent because that was, I think it took place in the 70s and you're kind of doing a different setting for Dracula. And it wasn't really the Dracula retelling. It was a brand new story. So to me, though, that's what excites me. I obviously, I like the original. I love the one that Coppola did.
Bram Stoker's Dracula.
I actually think that's my favorite.
It is.
I think it tells the story the best. I think Gary Oldman's the best Dracula.
Yeah, it's the most experimental, sexualized,
and showing all
crazy,
the different things he can
abstract,
be, the different creatures.
Oh, yeah. No, my favorite's Bram Stoker's Dracula.
I thought a special movie.
I thought Dracula, the Todd Browning, I think that's got a certain, it's got its charms and its gothic, its gothic atmosphere, but its pacing is really sluggish, and it's kind of, I watch it every once in a while, every other Halloween, not every Halloween, and I still have a hard time getting through it. I respect it, but I recently rewatched Bram Stoker's Dracula and just was like, this thing is a perfect storm of craziness, drugs, sex, everything. Yeah.
And just gorgeous cinematography.
And just gorgeous. And set pieces. It's super, super gorgeous,
What about The Blood of These Whores is Killing Me? Udo Kier in Blood for Dracula and Paul Morrissey one.
That one's just kind of a trip to watch.
It's such a weird movie.
Yeah, it's just the whole movie feels awkward, but it somehow comes together and works.
What did you guys think about, the central question I think that you guys asked on your website this week, which is Dracula scary?
See,
I think back to almost every film, and I'm like, besides Bram Stoker's, it's very hard to think of him as a scary character because he's a romantic figure.
I think that's my problem is like, I don't even have like a favorite Dracula film because I would probably say Monster Squad because I
agree with you.
That
Dracula is a terrifying, awesome Dracula.
Yeah.
Like it's really powerful, monstrous.
Hissing, plays, he scared me when I was a kid, but none of the other Draculas do, to the point where they all kind of merge together in my brain. So I have problems kind of separating. Like if I love vampires, but I love them as kind of the shadowy underground, like Near Dark or the
Nosferatu,
Lost Boy.
Cool too.
I was going to say that when it's a Nosferatu Salem's Lot style, when it's a creature, not a normal man.
Yeah, like Shadow of the Vampire in Salem's Lot. Like,
those scare me. I also love the like, this is my secret, I must conceal, like Let the Right One In or Martin.
But they're just vampires, Dracula is
the Dracula
figure, right?
Is this regal, stagey, theatrical. Mm-hmm. I mean, and we talk about it, Whitney talks about in the article how, he goes past theatrical. He's like operatic. Like everything is romantic and stylized. And
wouldn't you like to see someone take a shot at it and not be like that, though? I mean, even Langella's one that gets close.
Well,
but something
Langella is the epitome of the romantic.
Right.
Christopher Lee was a balance of romance and horror, you know, and Langella was purely playing right to the soap opera moms.
I'd love to see not quite as gritty as like Fessenden's Habit, but now, like a movie happening right now in New York City. What does Dracula do? He's lived for 3,000 years. He's setting himself up in a penthouse. Who is he now?
I think that
comes in other shows.
A good version might be in the remake of Fright Night, where it's like he's clean cut.
Actually,
he's very attractive.
But that's not Dracula.
It's not Dracula.
It's a vampire.
But he's charming.
Yeah, he's Dracula, but he's got those features, which is the long lost love, that he lost a long time ago.
Did you guys see the show Jonathan Rhys-Meyers played him?
And I really liked him.
I really liked him in it. He had a high energy. But the guy I really liked was the guy in Penny Dreadful, and then the show kind of cut early. Yeah. It's the last season, and he's just like this interesting figure, but it felt like they didn't fully explore him by the end. But I was excited. I was like, ooh, that's a good Dracula, because he was kind of serious.
What about the guy in Waxworks?
I can't remember.
That guy was pretty good.
He's like a beefcake, and they're like eating raw meat. He's like,
Peter Steele Dracula.
yes, steak tartare.
So ridiculous.
You don't like steak tartare?
I never saw Dracula Untold. Did anyone see it here?
I thought it was okay.
It's superhero Dracula.
Origin myth kind of story? About the actual character Dracula?
Yes, it is about the prince to tragic hero, you know, where it's like, oh, here's why he doesn't like Silver. Oh, here's why the crosses don't work.
Now, see, that's where they all kind of blend together for me, because there was definitely a stretch in like the late 90s, 2000s, where all of these kind of vampire films came out that were doing the mythos. Like there was one where he was supposed to be, I can't even remember, the guy who betrayed Jesus.
I was watching Dracula 2000 the other day.
Is that Dracula 2000?
That's Dracula 2000.
Okay, I was like, it might be Queen of Blood. Judas. Yeah, okay, that is.
Butler, right?
Queen of Blood was around that same time. That's the one where he was in a band. And yeah.
Oh, man, I forgot about Vitamin C.
Yeah, so he's Judas in that one. But I remember all of these movies where they were kind of trying to explain the Dracula mythology.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was like legitimately like a cool idea. I was going to come to the table.
That one's kind of cool.
I couldn't finish it this week, but I was going to come to the table next week to talk about Dracula 2000. Because I decided to do a little revisit of that one. Oh my God, it is so bad.
I haven't seen it since it came out, and that's all I remember is the Judas bit and being like, "Well, that's cool."
Two more of those, right?
Oh yeah.
Oh my God,
one with Rucker Hauer, and then.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Well, you know what? The one that was really interesting, and Ryan, I think maybe you read the script, but wasn't Sherlock Holmes? No. Wasn't Neil Marshall going to do the tale of the, what's the name of the ship?
Mary Celeste.
No. Last Voyage of the Demeter.
Voyage of the Demeter, yeah.
Demeter, yeah.
When they're transporting.
When they're taking him to
Comes and the, you know they're all dead and you know they were going to do that story on the
on the ship
where he keeps coming out and
it was basically like a creature feature on a boat and it was a period piece and it was about them transporting and they don't know and it's told. It was cool. There was a piece I did when it was a Shock 2 drop that was kind of like the multiple Dracula projects that are in production or like in development.
That's what it was.
And it was Last Voyage of the Demeter. There was Vlad that Charlie Hunnam was developing and he wrote. And then there was Dracula Year Zero, which became Dracula Untold. And then there was a couple other ones. But The Last Voyage of the Demeter was a really well-written one by this writer, Braggy Schutt. And it put him on the map in terms of Hollywood, Hollywood credibility. And he became a fast-rising screenwriter in town. Yeah. But that was one that, like, Patrick Tatopoulos was going to direct. Neil was going to direct. It was, like, multiple filmmakers that, like, kept coming on board, but they just never pulled the trigger.
So do you think that they could make a Dracula film now and have it be scary?
No.
I think somebody could reinvent what he's been doing for the last one.
Sounds cool to me.
That does sound good, especially with
Neo. But yeah, I think contemporary is the key. Like that was the thing that's interesting about that documentary is they keep mentioning how for whatever reason you think Dracula and they just kept retelling it in the past with the exception of what's the one that Christopher Lee did? Dracula 1972.
Which was kind of badass because Dracula was like a businessman.
Right.
Yeah, I like that one.
That sounds cool.
It was funky.
I don't know. It's just, I mean, like I think that the Dracula as a name is a well-known commodity that people kind of look at and then they go, haha, okay, it's like old world monsters. You know?
I wonder though if you didn't title it and if that was like a shock halfway, like quarter of the way through, you revealed this character's identity, and like, oh shit,
I imagine that if you build a lot of goodwill in that movie that you don't call Dracula and you hide his name until like one hour in, then you say, oh, it's Dracula.
That might work.
What if
that would completely probably distract them from the rest of the goodwill that you built up making the movie.
It's the last 5 minutes. M. Night Shyamalan twist.
And he was Dracula.
Holy shit, he's Dracula.
I don't know, because Dracula seems like so much like kids fodder, right? Like even my daughter's really into the show Monster High and the main character is Dracula's daughter. Her name's Draculaura.
Doc Dracula,
Dr. Acula.
Dr. Acula.
Remember that? But the one I don't remember if he's Dracula. You saw it recently, Brides of Dracula, the one where the guy's like redhead.
Yeah, I think he's supposed
it's
to
a
be.
Gorgeous movie.
Oh,
that's probably my favorite.
Because they mentioned they didn't ask Christopher Lee to do that one.
That's super weird.
Forgive me for the timeline, people listening. I know it's in the doc, but I think it was like because they had already committed to Peter Cushing as Van Helsing.
Right, yeah, he's in.
But Christopher Lee had been the Frankenstein monster.
Uh-huh.
He had not clicked yet as Dracula. You know?
Oh.
They were both successful, and it might have been post-Brides of Dracula where they're like, what if we just put them both in the same movie? I think I'm getting that right. I'm not sure.
Okay.
It's a Terrence Fisher. It's a good one.
Yeah.
But I don't know if it can be scary. I mean, I don't think any of those are really scary movies. I mean,
there's the entertainment value because one of my personal favorites, my old roommate showed me, the Hammer – at one point had made a Dracula movie with the Shaw Brothers.
Mm. Oh, yeah. Oh, which is Golden Vampire.
The Legend of the Seven Golden Vampires.
It's amazing.
That movie's actually awesome.
It's good.
Yeah.
Like, really awesome. I think it's on a triple pack on DVD with a couple of the Christopher Lee ones, so that's a worthwhile package.
And the best performance, in my opinion, is still Klaus Kinski. The Herzog one. I think his portrayal is such. He's taking like what he saw of Nosferatu and giving it actual characterization.
Yeah, see, that's the thing. I don't even think of that one as Dracula. I think of it more as the shadow of a vampire.
Yeah, he is that creature. But just I stumbled on this, and I'll post it for people. A 10-minute interview. It's the only time he was on U.S. talk show with Letterman, early Letterman.
Wow.
And it's right after he did that movie, and he's such a strange character to interview. And Letterman's asking about the makeup, and he goes, "I hated the makeup, and you know, I hated Verna." I don't want to work with him, you know. But he makes me put on. I do it. I laugh at him. He's a silly man, you know. But it's a great. I'll post it. It's a really Letterman. It's kind of like when he had to do Joaquin Phoenix when Joaquin Phoenix was crazy that day.
Oh, that one. Yeah,
he was just fucking with him. It's kind of like that, but real.
Wow.
But Kinski, you know, Kinski took it seriously. That's the thing. If you take these characters seriously and you don't play them just as the romantic cliche, you could get something interesting out of because it's such a great lore. Yeah. You know, same with Wolfman. I mean,
do we know how they're doing? They're redoing it for this new Universal.
No, there was rumors that were going to bring in what's his face?
One?
Yeah, the Dracula 2000, Iron Dracula Untold, but who knows?
Yeah. Hmm. See, that falls to me in like the Underworld universe where I just don't take those monsters seriously. Yeah. But we'll see how The Mummy turns out. I mean, I like Tom Cruise and I think that could be a good movie.
Yeah.
I hope.
We'll see. Let us know if you find any of them scary. Yeah. We're always curious to hear what you think.
Scary and what are the best ones?
And check out,
I'm always looking for them.
The article that we have up, and it's the 1931 Dracula still scary? And it kind of goes through and evaluates why it's not scary, why most people perceive it as not, and then ultimately, you know, why it would have been perceived as scary at the time and why people might still find it so today.
Yeah.
Listener questions.
All right.
Oh, wait. I just want to drop two movies that I saw this week.
Oh, you got missed.
Oh, Ryan, we threw past that. I'm sorry. We're done.
It's all over now.
I just want to mention two movies.
Ryan's been seething for 20 minutes.
No. I just want to drop two. I mean, I'll save the other ones for next week because I caught up on two movies that I had not felt like I had never seen.
Oh, cool.
One being Intruder. The grocery store one.
Never seen it.
It's an awful movie. But I'll talk about that next week. I finally got to see Alone in the Dark with Donald Pleasance.
Oh, that's right. I was just looking at that at the start.
Yeah.
Did you get off TCM?
Huh? No. Alone in the Dark. You said he knows you're alone.
No, both. They were back to back on TCM. It was a double feature.
Got it. So Alone in the Dark. No. I saw it through other means because I couldn't find it anywhere else.
Yeah, that's cool.
But what a weird movie.
Yeah.
What a weird, weird movie about a bunch of escaped psychopaths that take advantage of a town-wide blackout. And then the movie pontificates about natural energy versus nuclear energy. So
and everyone's in it. Everybody's in the movie.
Including a hockey mask killer.
Yeah, a hockey mask killer that shows up for a bit and then disappears. Mm-hmm. But it's just such an oddball movie with a great twist because there was like a buried nugget in there that I didn't see coming
and
at all.
And a hot babysitter.
But
the opening scene, so as soon as I saw it this time because I didn't watch the whole thing again, opening sequence, which is a dream scene, it seems to me to set the bar for everything that Nightmare did in the sequels, which he directed too. So I was like, oh my God, even the lighting and the diner thing. Exactly the same.
Oh, absolutely. The kind of oddball, you know? Oddball
surreal.
Nightmare logic.
Surreal. So if you, for no other reason, watch the start of it and you'll go, it's a nightmare.
The other thing I want to drop on you guys is this 1964 film called Seance on a Wet Afternoon. Richard Attenborough.
Seance on a Wet Afternoon.
Oh, yeah. I saw that on your desk.
Yeah. Richard Attenborough stars in this movie about a couple who kidnap a child and hold her for ransom because the wife who is in this relationship is a medium. And what happens is once they kidnap the kid, she goes to the parents and is like, I can help you find your kid. I'm a medium. Yeah. Like I can help you.
Oh, wow.
And
that's
she
so
basically,
sleazy.
It's super crazy. And so what she does is she uses the kidnapping as a way to boost her, her fame. And then, of course, things go awry. But it is a fantastic movie. It's on Hulu. Criterion Collection released it. Black and white. It's got a little bit of slow burn quality to it. But please, please check it out. Because it was one of those weird movies I've never seen before. I bought the VHS at like Monsterpalooza. I was like, oh, that's a cool VHS. Of course, the VHS didn't work. Go VHS. And then I had to turn to digital to watch it. So it is a terrific, terrific film that's based on a book. I'm currently trying to track down the book so I can read that and just see if there's any like.
I am a
gaps.
Huge fan of that film. I think it's fantastic. But weirdly enough, I saw it after a New Zealand Film Festival. There's a Japanese remake.
Yes, called Seance.
And I was watching it, and it's about a guy. It's the same story, except the guy at the start, it's just like a blow up or blowout. It's a sound guy who has to go out into the trees to get good sound of wind. Yeah. And so he's sound recording wind, and then he ends up abducting the girl, and then things happen. And it's the exact same thing. But then when I went back to watch the original, I was like, oh, I like the original more. Yeah, like, it is Attenborough's really good.
I want to track down that because I'm fascinated by this movie and how it got made now. And then final thing, I just want to give a shout out to the Overlook Film Festival.
Oh, yeah.
We haven't given it a mention since they got announced, but this is taking place in Oregon at the end of April next year. You guys can find them on Facebook and Twitter, but we're going to have a part of it. I'm on the advisory board with a bunch of other great folks like Elijah Wood and the Spectrevision team and a couple other folks in town. But basically, it's the same creative team behind the Stanley Film Festival, but they branched off and went to the Overlook, which is basically the hotel that Stanley Kubrick shot The Shining
at.
The
one you actually see.
Mm-hmm. You see
the helicopter shots.
And apparently, from my understanding, is the drive up there is the drive that they take at the beginning.
Oh, man, we get to go up the Sidewinder.
Yes.
That's so, I hope we get awesome. There
so
hard.
So I would suspect you'll see most of us there.
Suspect.
We want this. Yeah.
I'm working on this. I'm working on this.
Talking about suspicions.
We got some events there. I'm pretty psyched.
You guys for sure. Yeah. So maybe all of us will make an appearance.
Yeah. It's all gears in the works.
And speaking of suspicions, for you guys listening out there, yesterday on the site we announced that Blumhouse.com will be sponsoring Texas Frightmare.
Yes, we did.
Wait, isn't that the festival we used to go to and haven't been for a year?
Isn't that funny?
Yeah. Wow. We skipped a year,
guys. I get to go to my first Texas Frightmare.
Wait, we didn't say we were all going. We just said that Blumhouse.com was sponsoring it. Oh.
Okay, we might be there.
What can that mean? All right.
Hey, okay, we're going
to
be
Ryan,
there.
It's a process in the works. I'm talking to our people. I'm going to try to get you there.
I just said I was going.
Gears are turning, Ryan. Gears are turning.
Oh, damn. It's the likelihood is very good.
Yeah.
Aren't they having an amazing reunion of some kind?
I just saw that they've
got multiple. Yeah, but something we all really love.
Yeah, they got a couple people from Stranger Things. The kid from The Shining is going to be there.
Ah,
yeah.
Danny. That's been one of my life dreams.
Danny should be there.
Especially after I started dating the Shining twins last time I was there.
The cast of 31 is coming. Yeah, they've got a lot of, and you can check out the Blumhouse.
Hey, I like that Richard Brake guy.
He's great. He's going to be there. There we go.
Our guy John Humphrey would be really excited about the 31.
I'm going to introduce this one more time.
All right.
Listener questions.
Listener questions.
What is that?
That was a button I pushed.
No, don't get into that.
Hold on, one more time.
It adds production value.
Let's hear it again.
Ryan's going to do it.
You don't have it.
No. Anyway, so instead of, last week we did a little trivia. This week we opened it up to you guys just so we can answer so many questions. Yes. So let's burn through some of these really quick. Mike O'Day.
Ryan still hasn't recovered from my falsetto.
Listener questions. All right.
Reminds me of another podcast.
I don't listen to that, so I wouldn't know.
go on. Listener questions.
Start podcast wars here.
No.
All right, so from Mike O'Day, we'll start off with his. He says, I'm trying to get my girlfriend into watching horror. She's relatively young, 26, and I figure that 90s horror is a good way to start. Mm. What is each of your recommendations for her to start with?
Lake Placid. It's fun, accessible. What? It is.
Really? All right.
It is.
David E. Kelly horror comedy?
Not even, no hesitation.
Lake Placid.
No whammies. I'm doubling down on Lake
Seriously.
Placid.
Mike, maybe you should listen to the girl.
It's fun. It is accessible. It still has some scares in it, but at the same time, you leave it, and it's fun. I mean, I think that that's kind of one of the biggest things when you're entering horror is you don't want to be like, okay, well, let's just Event Horizon this
all right,
shit.
All right,
you want to kind of start fun.
Okay.
Lake Placid, bitches.
It depends how much of a rookie. If we're talking like she hasn't seen any of the major ones, I would actually go further back. To me, Nightmare on Elm Street is such a great entry point. No, I know, but I'm saying
that's
like,
why I went Lake Placid
earlier. If I have to go 90s, I'm going Cherry Falls.
We're already off. Terrible start on their recommendations.
No, Cherry Falls is good.
Cherry Falls?
Sure. He said 90s.
You might get some, I said.
That's 2000. Well, technically 90s. I would say...
I'm missing on both decades. I've missed the mark twice.
Scream's a good one.
If you're aiming for
90s,
that's
it's
a given.
I would say Candyman.
Candyman's great.
That's a little intense.
No, because you have a strong female protagonist.
Romantic.
You have a great procedural. element. You're dealing with an urban legend,
that kind of stuff.
I say horror comedy, so I say either Shaun of the Dead or American Werewolf in London. I feel like those will
neither 90s
are good. It does. It He said, I figured 90s.
Oh, okay.
The word
okay,
is.
Okay,
because
fine.
She's in her 20s. Could be any
okay.
horror.
All right, so hopefully we've answered that question.
I want to go deeper into this.
if we're aiming 90s, I would also say Mimic was one of
what?
My... I liked that yeah, one.
I haven't rewatched it since. Okay. But I want to watch a director's cut, which yeah. I've never seen.
It's a fun little film.
All right. Alex Bowley asks, what film would you most like to see a sequel to where none exists? He goes with Nightbreed, which
yeah,
I think you'd probably
talked
yeah,
about a lot
yeah. we've talked about that.
I feel like this is something we've made it like done 8 articles on regularly because you know we watch movies all the time, and every time I'm like revisiting something, I'm always like, why didn't they make another one of these?
Yeah.
So it kind of comes up a lot. I think it's a sin that there was never a sequel to either version of My Bloody Valentine. That's kind of the obvious one.
Yep, mm-hmm. And Deep Rising.
Oh,
boom!
You and Becca, love child.
Dropping some Treat Williams on
we'll,
that.
We'll talk, Take Ryan.
I would just say, funnily
that,
enough, because
that was a shout out to Brian Collins, y'all.
He mentioned Candyman. The reason I'm going to say Candyman, even though the sequels exist, because I started again recently, is the ending of Candyman, which basically posits her becoming this figure of horror. It's like it would be really interesting to have seen a Bernard Rose directed. Film about that character.
So, okay.
That,
so
I would kill to see that.
I'd literally say it's maybe in the last week or two.
Uh-huh.
It probably won't happen, but there's an interview with Bernard Rose saying that they're like, what project? Because he's been like, he redid Frankenstein.
Yep.
And mm-hmm. I think he's
yep.
wanted to do his own take on all the monsters. Uh-huh. I don't know if that's going to happen, but they asked him, what would you really love to make? He's like, well, me and Tony would love to do a proper sequel mm-hmm. to Candyman, a sequel
Hell
to
yeah.
ours. So it's just funny that you mentioned that. I think the problem is the rights are in so many places
yeah,
now.
Yeah, sure.
That
They're
it'd be really
up.
Difficult to obtain that property. But I'm with you. I, would
I
love
just
to
think
see
that was quite haunting
Bernard
ending.
Rose
and it's like, I'd
see
like
it,
yeah, and Bernard Rose doing it. It's a beautifully made film.
Yeah. Let's see. Daniel Harrington, who is the gentleman that has a Shockwave's tattoo on his body.
Oh, shit.
So extra special shout out to you, Daniel. Since horror TV is on the rise, what are some horror properties you would like to see adapted into a miniseries or TV show?
This one was rumored, but I was always psyched by the Critters concept.
What?
Seriously, it was rumored as a TV show, and I was like, oh, that'll be
You know
fun.
What? You guys are
and
laughing.
And then it never happened.
But let me tell you something. The other day, I think it was on El Rey, I caught a little, like, the middle of Critters 2, and I kind of forgot. I mean, you think of Critters, but I forgot about, like, the whole alien Like the
oh, there's
faceless
like a larger,
aliens
yeah, yeah.
that become like warriors that fight them, and I'm like, you know
whole
what?
Thing.
This is like a whole like sci-fi epic. It could be a sci-fi yeah. epic kind of horror, you know, thing.
And I'm not uh-huh. saying so, like take that. It serious or anything.
No, it'd be fun.
I'm saying like take it like Ash versus the Evil Dead, where you
sure.
are aware that you're watching little fuzzy, you
yeah,
know,
well,
walls
the,
with
that's
teeth.
That's the tone of the original.
But yeah, I always thought that that was an interesting TV show concept that I was kind of like amiss that it never happened.
I would say. There are two. I would say one is Cat People.
Mm-hmm.
I think Cat People would be really interesting, and also The Howling.
Oh, yeah.
The Howling would be interesting as well. I think just because you're dealing with that community and you could deal with all sorts of kind of like it could be a weirdo commentary on relationships today as well mm-hmm. as being a kind of a scary werewolf show. It's mostly like – Oh, no, Cat People's Universal. Cat People would be interesting as well, just to kind of delve into their background and their history and stuff like that. And another one I've always wanted to do is Night of the Comet.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, the big one, too.
No.
Interesting. What about you, Rob?
You know
There's
what?
So many. I always think
yeah.
of this every week when I watch things, but then it's kind of...
Well,
and
yeah,
we've done a series of lists of these on the site,
yeah.
I know.
Yeah, I mean, so like all the big ones have been adapted.
Yeah.
You know, they're already there. I guess one that I would pull out of nowhere, you know, I've been... periodically watching the Wolf Creek series, which mm-hmm. I actually think is really well done so far. I think I'm like 3 in. And seeing that style, I would love it if there was like a 6-episode miniseries of Texas Chainsaw in that vein.
Hmm.
Something similar where it's like the family's like almost like the plot of 2 where it's like Lefty, like the Dennis Hopper character chasing these guys.
Yeah.
Like I think that like that would be the most batshit like kind of show if you had this whole family on the run from, you know, like a Lefty type. I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, I feel like I come up with something different every week. I'll do it on Twitter.
I will also say that I've always, and hey, I can say this now because I'm writing one of the comic books. I've always thought that Hellraiser.
Can we have a sound effect for any cheap plug?
I know, cheap plug. Come on, guys.
Yeah, congratulations.
I'm really fucking excited
no,
about
no, no,
that.
Seriously, yeah, I've been able to cool. give you a congrats. That's
yeah,
amazing.
I hadn't even mentioned it on
Hellraiser.
The show yet. It just dawned on me. Yeah, so Dave and I wrote one of the upcoming Hellraiser comic books that Sarah
Boom. Is it like a graphic novel or a single like a comic you can buy?
It's going to be like a single comic
okay,
that
cool.
you can buy. But they're doing a series. And yeah, so we're like in involved in the project, nice. I'll say, in a larger capacity.
It's too cool.
But yeah, so the Hellraiser comics from the 90s, which I know I've talked about on Killer POV, were always really influential to me because they were kind of anthology, like where each week it was the Hellraiser mythology, but in a completely different setting. Like one was in the South Africa and apartheid, and then the next week it would be medieval times, and but always with the Hellraiser mythos. And I always thought that those would make like a crazy good anthology TV show.
Hold the phone, motherfuckers. I got it. The best, just like Westworld. So imagine the scale of Westworld, HBO. They live.
Yeah.
And you're in that world. Oh, and they come down, you're figuring out. And oh, man, without wrestlers, even though I love them,
hey,
don't
come
get
on,
me
Roddy
wrong.
Was amazing.
But if you're doing
the
a
the fight
contemporary
scene's an
version,
entire episode.
Yeah,
I hope.
But a contemporary. Like the way
episode
Westworld
six,
keeps
it's all fight.
It's all fight.
I know.
It's
I think
like
that
their
would be
wall
cool.
episode.
And especially topical.
Yes.
Because we now live in it.
We were going to discuss it.
He keeps bringing it up. But let's see. Clancy Peterson wants to know, pairing up films is like making a good mixtape. I agree. The movement between films and how each of the audience feel in the moment is as important as the films you decide to screen. What are some of your memorable screenings of multiple films, ones that worked or ones that epically failed? So I guess like best double bills sort of deal.
I'm going to drop a name. And I feel bad for this, but it's always stuck with me. When I was on the set of Jennifer's Body and I was interviewing,
yes.
I had an opportunity to like hang out with Diablo Cody.
Hey.
And I got to learn what a big horror fan she was. And we were talking about great double features. And this one always stuck with me because I would love to program it. And I think some, she might have. But it was Fright Night and Nightmare on Elm Street 3.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was just like, yes. That is a perfect pairing of everything that sums up my youth and the fun horror I gravitated to. So I'm going to go with Fright Night and Nightmare on Elm Street 3.
I like it.
This one's a bit of a deep cut, and then a blockbuster film combined together. So when I was first researching How Sue, the Japanese film House, a long time ago, Criterion had just put it out on DVD. And they talked about it, about how it was a – was supposed to be the Japanese answer to Jaws. And you watch the film and you're like, how the fuck? Because it's about a slumber party full of girls who go to a house and there's a ghost and one of them gets her head cut off and there's an evil cat. And it's just a batshit crazy movie. But we decided to pair it up with Jaws. So a group of us got together and watched Jaws and then House Sue, which was supposed to be the Japanese version of Jaws. And it's amazing because you watch it and you catch notes of like, well, maybe, but it became the most analytic discussion I think I've ever had about a film, where we were kind of like trying to break down how they could have taken one and made it to the other and how it could have worked. But yeah, so I recommend watching the two of them back to back because it will really make you think.
So. I liked, one I tried recently when they both came out was, and I talked about it on the old show, but Messiah of Evil and It Follows.
Oh, good pairing.
Because you can also throw in Carnival Souls and Soul Survivor too.
Yeah.
Because they all have a similar tone. But,
oh, yeah.
But I think Messiah of Evil and It Follows together actually improve both films because there is this weird continuity of something that is unexplainable that's following. They're never, neither film really ever fully explains what's going on. And I think that improves both of those movies.
I also think a little bit of Tremors and Deep Rising. You know,
nice. You keep working on
a monster movie that kicked off a great, a cool decade, and then
one that
and then closed
it
out. Yeah.
I guess we could read another one here.
Yeah,
if I could read it. Let's see.
We'll do one more.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, no pressure. Have you got them up?
Yeah.
Okay.
Let me see.
I haven't read them yet.
What horror movie? All right. Jay Bromfield asks, "What horror movies, if any, did each of you guys appreciate more after rewatching them, and why do you think that happened?"
Well, for me, I don't know. I mean, I have to think about a specific, but it's almost all early Cronenberg. He's one of those directors, every time I saw him when I was young, I just wasn't ready for them. Like Dead Ringers, I've talked about before, just traumatized me too much. And there's quite a few of those films that are, I guess, the serious horror films that I've now gravitated to, ironically. When I first saw them, they were often not what I wanted when I was young, and they kind of were too much for me, Dead Ringers being the ultimate. And then I saw it years later, and I was like, wow, it's a fucking masterpiece, you know?
Yeah, I got to agree that it definitely was the ones that I watched way too young and didn't understand. And then watching later, I was like, oh, this is like next level shit that I didn't catch when I was a kid. I also will say I hated It Follows the first time I saw it. And the second time, I can't say it was my favorite film of the year, but I had a lot more respect for the scares that it pulled off.
Yeah. I would say, I mean, there were two. One, which is way overdue on my watching list, and I need to do this very soon, is Don't Look Now. with Sutherland, and I picked up the Criterion not too long ago, and it's just been sitting on my shelf. I need to watch it, but I remember the first time I watched it, I just didn't get it. Like I could not. I thought it was very too somber for my taste, too grim for my taste, and then the finale came, and I was like, oh, that's the movie I would have loved to have seen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But and then I watched it again, and I was like, oh no, I was an idiot. I get it, but I want to see it now. With some even fresher eyes. And then the other one is Session 9, which I thought I absolutely hated. And then
I had yet to revisit, but I got the blue, so I'm going to. Because I kind of was like, I remember thinking it was okay, but it wasn't the big deal everyone was
when
saying.
When I saw it in the 90s, I was bored by it. I was seriously, like, it's a guy listening to tapes the whole time.
It's a guy, yeah. And it was just like, there's some sort of, I don't know, there's a quality about it that's just too lackadaisical. Mm-hmm. Like, I was like, oh, I hate these guys. They're not doing what they're supposed to be doing. There's no forward momentum, but it's not a movie about forward momentum. It's about the here and now and the kind of mental degradation this guy is going through and losing it. And all the other things that kind of come into play, sound effects, atmosphere, all that stuff. It's all part of the larger scheme. I watched it here recently in our screening room, and I was just like, nope. I still like this now. Yep.
The other big one I had recently was actually as a kid, I actually was underwhelmed by the remake of The Blob, because I think when I was young, when it actually came out on VHS, I was like, all I could see was Kevin Dillon's hair and his performance, and I didn't like it at the time. And rewatching it at the screening Ryan put on and then The Twilight Time, it's literally one of my favorite films now. I love that movie. And so it's funny that I wouldn't have liked it when I was young, when it's more likely you might have, that kind of movie.
Right.
I think it's just phenomenal now. It's such a fun movie.
Yeah, that's one I loved as a kid. Yeah. But no, I'm with Ryan. Session 9 is a big one. A lot of the stuff that Scream Factory kind of puts out again is always kind of, you know, it gives me a reason to revisit some of those movies. So off the top of my head, I've always said on the show earlier, I love the Scanner sequels, but I don't like the first one as much. And I think it's because of that lead. The lead actor is not as strong as the rest of the cast, or as, you know, at least the sequels are kind of over the top and fun for me.
Poor Michael Ironside.
But Michael Ironside's great in it. He's great in it.
Yeah, it's the other guy.
Had
it been David Hewlett in that one, the guy from Penn, he would have been great, because he's intense. So
But Criterion put it out on Blu-ray maybe, a year ago or so? Mm-hmm. And it is like such a flawless, pristine presentation of the movie that I hit all the lights off. And even though I had a newfound appreciation for it. A lot of times it's when these movies get restored and you get to see them in like the best possible quality. So Scanners, Prince of Darkness is one that I didn't like that much as a kid. And I still find it, it's so weird. In fact, I think my appreciation for it came, Ryan showed it last year here at our offices, in our screening room, as kind of a, weird movies that Blumhouse would have made in the late 80s, 90s.
Let me introduce you to some movies that you might have missed, and that on a budget we could have made. Like,
was
in
that
the late 80s.
Before or after it played in the church?
It was after.
We saw it in the church, and actually, I really appreciated that too. Yeah. That was a great.
I actually completely agree. That's when I felt like, as a kid, was my least favorite Carpenter, right, and now I really like it.
Well, Elric's referencing, they actually did a one-off screening in the church it takes place in, and him and I got to go.
And who was sitting next to me on the right?
It was one of the guys from Big Trouble in Little China.
The lightning guy.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And we got all excited, but it was cool to be in the actual room where all of it takes place was a really fun thing. So. That's a good one. But all right. Well, anyways, thank you so much for your questions. Yeah. We really appreciate it. And, you know, we could keep this up on the Facebook page as well.
Yeah.
Speaking of socials, obviously, if you like us on Facebook, it's just Shockwaves. On Twitter, we're Shockwaves Pod.
And Instagram.
Instagram is what Shockwaves Podcast.
Yep.
Yeah. So on Instagram, we're Shockwaves Podcast.
We tried to stay consistent, but you know, sometimes social media just doesn't allow that.
Well, they won't allow it. There's other Shockwaves out there. Books, vinyl releases, everything.
Apparently. So we're trying.
And more reviews. And more. We're always looking for more reviews on iTunes.
Yeah.
That helps boost our star rating.
Keep spreading
the love. Yeah. All that stuff.
That we really appreciate. And so that's that. And we'll be back with part 2 of this episode on Monday, where you guys love when we have like the Scream Factory guys on. We did a great episode with Severin. We're going to talk to some of our friends from Lionsgate who are behind the new Vestron line. So hopefully you guys will get a kick out of that. We'll see you on Monday.
Have a good weekend.